So with those very brief instructions and a number of very excited attendees chiming in that they're able to see things and everything looks and sounds okay, I think we have concluded our technical reminders and we can get ready to start today. So at this time, I will ask one of my additional moderators in the background to go ahead and place the presentation materials up on the screen. And I'll turn the floor to our session facilitators to begin with our introduction. So I'm going to pull a number of speakers up here on camera, and we can go ahead and get started. And then Josie, once I see those presentation materials up on the screen, I will confirm and let you know that we are good to go.
Great. Thanks, Jean. Could you stop sharing your slides, please?
You've got it.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm waiting for slides to come up. Great. Thank you. Hi. Welcome, everyone. I don't know if you can see me yet, but my name is Alexis Rourke Reyes, and we are so glad that you could join us for this webinar discussing how EPA is working towards Superfund site cleanups and reuse options that are even more resilient to climate change and extreme weather events as we continue to see those. And we all learn more about how to be resilient in that space. Again, my name is Alexis Rourke Reyes. I'm the program manager for the Superfund redevelopment program at EPA. And just want to take a second to introduce my partner in crime, Chelsea Sebetich from the Superfund redevelopment program at EPA as well. Let's say hi.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Alexis. My name is Chelsea Sebetich, and I support the Superfund redevelopment program at EPA headquarters.
Great. All right. Well, we'll hear more from Chelsea in a bit on one of our really exciting initiatives called the Superfund Job Training Initiative. But in the meantime, just wanted to give you an overview. If this is your first time joining one of our webinars, we're so happy that you're here. If you're coming back, we're really happy that you're here. So thank you. These webinars, we hope that they share valuable information, success stories, challenges, and to hope to inspire you if you're in the Superfund space in particular, but you know, any kind of contaminated land reuse, to think about the guidance, the tools, the lessons, best practices that we have to offer and make us take us up on some of those. And with that, we'll go to the next slide. So just for an overview of this webinar, we're going to discuss EPA tools and resources that are available to climate change. We're going to talk about the Superfund redevelopment program kind of overall at first. And then we have Carlos Pachon with us, who's from our EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And he's going to give an overview of climate change and remedy protectiveness at site cleanups, and also discussion on redevelopment visioning with resilience in mind. After that, we have a special guest, Kelly Runzel. She's the Senior Director of Corporate and Community Engagement for the Student Conservation Association. So this is a not part of EPA. It's another nonprofit group, and I'm excited to hear with you about that and the opportunities that they provide all over the country to build local resilience to climate change. Then we're going to wrap things up with kind of a summary of some of the available tools, again, and resources, so that you'll have them kind of top of mind and be able to get started. And then we'll have some time for questions and answers, hopefully. So go to the next slide, Josie. Thank you. So before we get into all the tools and about, you know, Superfund redevelopment, we thought we would do kind of a baseline for folks about what Superfund sites are. Because the Superfund program has a, what is a Superfund site? It's Superfund was established in 1980. It's established an act called, we know it's for shorthand as CERCLA. It's Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act. And so that act, if you want to know more about it, there's a link to it on the bottom of your screen. But that gives EPA the authority to clean up contaminated sites and requires parties that are responsible for contamination to perform the cleanups or reimburse EPA for EPA-led cleanup work. And even though determining liability is not always an easy task and can be a many-year process, But in order to address cases that sometimes a responsible party is not identified or unable to pay, Congress established a trust fund that initially consisted of $1.6 billion and was later increased to $8.5 billion. And this trust fund, so that's the super fund that we're talking about when you say super fund, is that's what's been drawn on taxpayer dollars, as well as an excise tax on petroleum and chemical manufacturers. And that's the origin of that nickname. You want to go to the next slide, please? Thank you. So in response to that, there's a lot of work that goes on all over the country at EPA and with partners in states and with the responsible parties as well on cleaning up the sites. But we're really lucky to also have something called the Superfund Redevelopment Program. And that's a program that supports EPA staff in all of our 10 regions and also the communities that have Superfund sites located nearby and other partners, think about future use opportunities and how they can integrate reuse options that are appropriate into the cleanup process. So not after it's cleaned up, but during the cleanup process, sometimes during the planning process. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. There are so many examples of successful Superfund site reuse all over the country. Here are a couple of pictures. For us, we have to have the puppies in there. We can never have a presentation without them. And that's my dog love. But you know, there's so many different projects out there, and we're gonna hear a little bit more about alternative energy development projects that happen at Superfunds, because we know that y'all came here because you're interested in resilience. And there's a lot of exciting things to report there. So, you know, just kind of a big picture again on redevelopment, there's a lot of unique challenges in terms of how do you keep protectiveness at the site? How do you keep contamination in the way that was the remedy that was kind of decided upon? How do you keep the folks that live and work, play around Superfund sites safe? How do you address some of the stigma that might have surrounded Superfund sites areas in the communities that they're found in? And then also liability protections. But really, I think the amazing thing that we learn about, you know, every day is that there are more and more different creative uses that people have come up with to reuse these spaces in ways that provide all kinds of benefits. Just one thing to make sure that everyone's clear on is that EPA doesn't own the sites and we don't control local land use. So, you know, things like zoning or planning decisions like that. But what we do is provide technical assistance and other kinds of resources that can help kind of inform and facilitate conversations, especially for partners in local government or others that may not have the resources to do that. So to the next slide, please. Thank you. So again, you know, reuse is, why is it important to EPA, and why is it such a central function of Superfund and all the work that goes around, that goes on in the EPA regions? It's part of our mission. Our mission is to promote, protect human health and the environment. And so through reuse, this is a way that EPA can identify and partner with long-term stewards for Superfund sites, people that are gonna take care of the sites after they've been cleaned up. And that also can leverage really important benefits for communities. One of the benefits that we wanted to kind of highlight for this group that's very climate interested in climate change in particular is that the other benefit of reusing sites is that you're preventing greenfield sites from being developed. So for every acre of brownfield or contaminated land that is redeveloped, it's estimated that 4.5 acres of greenfield, so undeveloped land, is protected. And that I think has a lot of important benefits in terms of ecosystem services, air quality, and you know, recreational use and many biodiversity, all kinds of things. I think Carla is going to get into that a little bit later. But another thing that's really important to reuse in terms of one of the benefits is social equity. And so thinking that when community needs are accounted for, again, Superfund sites have impact communities in a lot of ways, and some of that can result in social challenges. And so, you know, we really take care to develop strong relationships with the community. We have a robust community involvement program, and folks that are assigned to work on that every Superfund site. And so, you know, the idea is we really try to encourage development that is equitable, that's done in light of environmental justice concerns, and do that in close partnership with communities. And then finally, you know, economic benefits. So you see this kind of statistic highlighted here. And this is, you know, we're really fortunate to be able to have information on the reuse that happens at a number of sites. Not all, it's a big job to try to collect all of that. But from that research, we've been able to determine that the sales that have been generated by businesses on Superfund sites are over $65 billion each year. So we talked about in the beginning, when we talked about Superfund program, what that budget looked like, but you can see the return on the investment here is really high. And so we're really happy that we have that information and that we're able to share it with you all. So a couple other things, if you want to go to the next slide. Okay, so we talked about a little bit before about alternative energy development on Superfund sites. And every year our program puts out a report that outlines the number of sites and which sites have renewable energy projects going on there. So that's, you know, wind, solar, landfill gas, geothermal, and then biomass. And we kind of break those out. And then in addition, you can also see the number of projects, because sometimes you'll have multiple projects on one Superfund site. And then also how many megawatts of power are generated at those sites. And so, you know, when we try to do a profile of each of those. So just as a little spoiler alert, we're about to put out our 2022 report. And in this report that you see here, you see that there were 75 projects on 73 sites. And, you know, this coming year, it's almost final, that we're excited to report that over 80 sites have projects. So this is an increasing area. And, you know, it's, again, part of EPA's mission to kind of bolster our resources in terms of renewable energy as well. So there's a lot more information about this online if you want to take a look at that. There's information on individual projects. And then we every year we kind of do a summary like this. So go to the next slide. There's one other resource that we wanted to highlight for you all at EPA. It's not part of the Superfund redevelopment program, but we work closely with them. It's called Repowering America's Land Initiative. And it's another EPA initiative that encourages renewable energy development on current and former contaminated lands, landfills, mine sites, and also does this, again, in alignment with that community vision that we talked about, to kind of make sure that we're addressing some of the community concerns, because that's really important in all kinds of development that we partner in. So some of the resources that this initiative has is they have mapping and screening tools. All those little yellow squares that you see highlighted there are highlighting different projects all over the country. And one of the other interesting things, so you can kind of click on each one of those and understand, you know, where the project is located, how much energy is generated, and some more of the kind of basic stats about it. And then another thing just to highlight for folks is that we do technical assistance. And a lot of times that results in feasibility studies. We partner with the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab to look at projects that may not have other means to conduct a feasibility study for some kind of renewable energy. We're getting a lot of requests on solar, and there's kind of a working group that's in place to review those. And so yeah, just wanted to highlight that for you. Again, you can feel free to look up that resource. We go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So again, the ultimate goal of, you know, Superfund program is to return sites back to productive use in a protective manner. And I know Carlos will hit on that too. And that, you know, that's number one for us, is protecting human health and the environment. So making sure that all the work that was done to address the contamination and keep people safe is still intact is number one. And one thing I didn't mention is the Superfund overview, but EPA does maintain kind of a regular review of these sites every 5 years, even after they're cleaned up. But during the course of that, I think it's been an interesting opportunity for the redevelopment team to observe all the changes that are happening and all the creative ways that people are using these lands. And you can see some of them here, from recreational, commercial, you know, again, you see a solar fund, but there's kind of every use under the sun that we've seen on these sites. And that's a really exciting thing. So we just are really happy to support that potential. And go to the next slide, please. Great. And yeah, one other message just to drive home. I know I'm going a bit longer here in the introduction. So one other message just to drive home is that sites can be and are redeveloped at any stage of cleanup. And so again, you'll see here, this is a landfill project that's highlighted here. But if you think about when, you know, each Superfund site is unique and has its own causes of contamination, the way that contamination has existed or spread over that area. And so each one has a very uniquely designed remedy. And Carlos is going to talk about those. And they do take into account climate condition, you know, and weather conditions into that original design. And so while they're doing that process, we also have the opportunity to work with local communities, local stakeholders, and figure out what vision might be out there for the site. And so that way you can kind of inform the remedy that is selected, the choices that are made, and how it's cleaned up can be informed and can be kind of made more efficient when you do that, when you have an idea of what reuse might be interesting for the community there. So I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chelsea. Let's see, talk about Superfund job training or workforce development. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Alexis. Hi again. As part of our background intro to all things Superfund, I'm now going to take just a couple minutes to go over another area of work that I support in addition to the Superfund Redevelopment Program, called the Superfund Job Training Initiative. So going by Super JTI for short, this is a high-level look at the program. At its core, Superfund Job Training Initiative is a job readiness program that targets underemployed and unemployed residents of Superfund communities to give them free remediation cleanup training to work at the cleanup in their community. So it's important to understand that every project that we do looks a little bit different because every site is different. So these are just the general operating principles that we work within in Super JTI, but we are a very flexible program and each program is tailored to the needs of each site. So that's one of the great things about it. Bringing Super JTI to a site means that EPA headquarters is going to organize and provide site-specific Superfund cleanup job training at no cost to participants, as well as hire organizations locally to provide various aspects of the training. The positions are generally entry level. It doesn't all need to be cleanup work. For us, success is employment for our graduates when they walk out. And it doesn't necessarily all need to be at the site, but that's the goal of our program. We also can't guarantee employment for graduates, but we do our very best. And identifying those opportunities beforehand is one of the main requirements for greenlighting a project. So we also say under/unemployed because it is an unpaid training program and period of time. We ask folks to come in for 3 to 4 weeks. Kind of depends on how long the training program is. It's, you know, tailored to the site and the needs. And it's a pretty big commitment on their part. So we really try to be good stewards of people's time and do best by them to make sure that they're making a good investment in themselves. So threading the needle between when the local needs and site conditions properly align is often the hardest part of this process, but that's when we're able to roll out a project and provide this awesome benefit to the community. So if you're interested, you can find more specific info about the program at the link on the slide. And if you have any questions, please feel free to follow up. And with that, I will pass the presentation over to Carlos Pachon to discuss climate resiliency and Superfund site reuse.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And if it's okay, I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. I'll try from this side. You could please confirm when you can see my screen.
Carlos, we see your screen, but just not the slides in presentation mode.
Oh, you see my assistant?
Yeah.
Okay. This is my assistant. We're actually on a field trip. Here we go. Okay.
Oh, you'll want to swap the view. Sorry, Carlos. It's showing us the presenter view.
Oh, okay.
So it's okay. You can go up and go into it, and then I'll show you what to do. So you can go back into slideshow mode.
Give me a second. Why is it doing this? Hold on. Let's just drag this out and then start again. Is it okay now?
No, I need you to go up to the display settings, and we're still seeing presenter view in the very upper left, and I want you to swap the view.
Got it. Thank you.
There we go. Everything looks great. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much, Jean. I appreciate that. So, hello. My name is Carlos Pichon. I'm with the Superfund program, and one of the areas I've been working in for a few years now is as team lead in climate, both in mitigation and adaptation. We'll touch on those very briefly. But I want to focus, as you've seen or heard earlier, on that core message of remedy protectiveness, but also talk about how decisions we make in ensuring that our remedies are protective can inform redevelopment questions at our sites. And as suggested, we want to see how we can leverage our mission and cleanup authorities in Superfund to help communities in the broader vulnerability challenges they may face. In other words, our core mission has not changed. We are not now in a climate adaptation mission, but in implementing our mission, we can leverage what we have to do to ensure remedy resilience to help communities and capacity to address their vulnerabilities. And then I'll go on to talk a little bit about, you know, additional expansion of that concept. And that is how in building and operating our remedies to be resilient, we can also move in the direction that helps contribute to climate change adaptation. So on the bottom, almost everything I'm gonna talk about is available online. We have had a Superfund climate resilience site for quite a while. So feel free to explore that URL. And a lot of the fun stuff we'll be talking about is on there. Okay, so a couple of things about climate. One point I'd like to make is that a lot of the changes that we are seeing are real, of course, but they're not always dramatic. It's not always major events. This picture on the left is here in DC in the Tidal Basin, just off the Jefferson Memorial. And that mudflat you see there, when I moved to DC, it was a while back, it was almost 27 years ago, but that was old lawn, of course. And now it's basically a mudflat because it gets inundated so frequently. Now, I'm not saying this is all because of climate change. A lot of that has to do because that land is sinking, there's subsidence. But there has been, since it was built, about a foot increase in the average level of the tidal basin, including high tides. That's that other figure on the right that's nearby at the fish market here in Southwest Waterfront in DC. Those are tide markers that have been recently put in, very interesting. And of course, the point to make here is that what used to be a flood is often nowadays considered a high tide. So those nuisance high tides are getting so common that we are seeing this progressive change, maybe very fast on geologic timescales, but on human scales still relatively slow. But we're seeing these progressive changes. So we always have to keep in mind that it's not just the big dramatic changes that are going to affect our decisions when it comes to climate, but these also gradually, say, chronic changes versus the big acute ones we see associated with storms. So I mentioned this earlier, but I wanted to emphasize these key concepts. The first one is climate change mitigation. That's really where many of us started off a couple of decades ago, at least, looking at our greenhouse gas releases and trying to figure out, it was on the science side, trying to understand the mechanisms through which they affect climate change, not whether or not they actually affect it, but the mechanisms through which they affect it, and also trying to figure out what is the best way to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and that is the mitigation side, reducing greenhouse gas emissions. On the other hand, climate change has been happening, and there does seem to be a certain level of acceleration. We know that's happening. It's going to affect us. So the question is, how do we integrate what we know about changes in our climate into our program operations? And that is what is known as adaptation. The actions we take are adaptation. The results of those actions are resilience. Resilience is what we get when we adapt. Resilience and the capacity to continue under future climate conditions. So that takes us to this question as to our sites. What we try to highlight with our project managers, when it comes to climate change, it's a huge topic. It's a very broad topic. It affects our lives in many, many ways. But we're trying to narrow it down to specific actionable questions for our project managers. Now, a basic question for the agency and for all federal agencies or any organization is how is climate change likely to affect the ability of your office to achieve its mission and strategic goals? Now, we can narrow that down even further to the site manager. And the question for project managers is, how is climate change likely to affect the protective zero remedy, and what action do I need to take to ensure its resilience, the resilience of that protectiveness of the remedy put in place under future climate conditions? That is a core question we should carry with us when we're asking ourselves in the Superfund program, how do we address climate change? And at the core, it's expandable. It's got multiple rings outside of it. But at the core is, how can we ensure that our remedy will be protective under future climate conditions? Now, we'll talk in a minute about, you know, the regulatory authority and the CERCLA, but there's definitely are a lot of policy drivers to get us there. There are several from two administrations ago, from the previous administration, and from the current administration. Now, Executive Order 14008, under the current administration, right off the bat, that was put out there, it required that all federal agencies update their climate change adaptation implementation plans. EPA, along with all the other federal agencies, put out draft plans in February of 21. If you Google it, it comes up right away. And we just submitted our contribution to the final, which should be released sometime shortly, I believe now in early October. That has also informed our agency strategic plan, EPA strategic plan 2022 to 2026. And just know that objective 1.1 for the whole agency is reduce emissions that cause climate change. So objective number one is mitigation. Objective number two is accelerate resilience to adapting to climate change. And that's what we're talking about today. There are several other executive orders in there that that have a lot of good information and goals that are related to what we're going to talk about today. The second one has a lot to do with the federal organizations and all of us working to identify means of operating in a more sustainable manner. That's 14, that's 57. And then 072 relates back to using natural systems. We're going to close out on that topic. There's a lot of very solid, robust policy drive and a lot of science in that area of how natural systems can help us build resilience. So we'll learn there's a very strong policy driver, and we're seeing a lot of those actions in the field. And finally, Executive Order 13690, you've noticed that number is kind of dated. That's because that's one we've been carrying forward. It's got some details about how to conduct a climate-informed scientific assessment at site specifically, and we'll be talking about that a little bit. So I'll quickly share with you our OLIM. OLIM is a program under which Superfund is home here in headquarters. We have other programs, the corrective action and waste program, the brownfields program, underground storage tanks, federal facilities. So we're all under what's called OLIM. In a certain area we all have in common is that we assess and clean up contaminated sites. So a lot of these actions are geared toward that. There are four that we already put out there since 2014, the last time our plan was updated. And then there are a few more on the right here that we are working on now. And I'll be talking about some of these in some more detail. Now, I mentioned that one of the areas, one of the key questions that for project manager, when it comes to climate change, is to understand how climate change may affect the protectiveness of their remedy. An important point to make here is that climate is already considered. Often we are asked, well, what about climate change? And I like to respond, well, climate itself is already considered. I mean, every decision we make, we live. Climate is a fact. Rain, temperature. Yes.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We are actually getting a lot of your Teams pop-ups on the screen.
Oh.
So what I want you to do is I'm going to stop your sharing.
Okay.
And then I want you to reshare, but just pick the PowerPoint presentation.
Got it.
Don't let us see the full screen.
Got it. Okay.
Hold sorry on. For that brief interruption.
No worries. Give me a second then.
And as you're doing that, I'll just remind the audience, remember our Q&A space is open throughout the entire broadcast. We've gotten a few comments and questions that have come on in, but we do strongly encourage you to share any of your thoughts or questions for the speakers into the Q&A at any time. And then we'll build up a nice queue and start reading through as many as we can later on when we go into our brief Q&A segment at the end.
Okay. Any questions I can ask, address now, Jean?
I think we're going to wait. We're going to get you back up on the screen here. But I did just want to confirm that I can see your slides and life looks good now, Carlos. So carry on. I apologize for that disruption. No worries.
Thanks for that, Jean. I know we went through a trial and I must have changed something. So thanks for that. Okay. So what I was saying is that we already factor climate into our decisions and our operations, our lives in general. We look out the window and decide what to wear every morning. That's weather, weather's a manifestation of climate. So it's something that we do every day. The question is climate change, as its name suggests, what are future conditions going to look like? And that's an area that we're trying to, get better at. The question is, what does forward-looking climate analysis tell us about conditions at our site? So if we take known climate change and we project conditions into the future, that's what we need to understand. It's that delta over current conditions. So what is going to be different down the road than what we have today and what we have had historically? Often we'll base our designs, our remedies, our decisions, et cetera, on historic data, but that historic data no longer represents future conditions. So we need to project future climate conditions and make a decision based on what that is going to look like. This very simple graph on the right is actually taken from site where we have been working on the multiple variables that are manifestations of climate change. And this one's a very common one, of course, it's a precipitation intensity. And here we see that in 2015, 2080, the 1 in 100 year rainfall event will have an additional 2 inches of precipitation. So the question is our infrastructure capable of handling that additional precipitation intensity? Or is the system that we're designing going to put in place, will it be able to handle that additional intensity? If we built it based on historic records, we would have about 6.5 inches. That would be our expectation of what 100 year event would be. But now we know that it's going to be closer to 10 inches. That's almost 3.5 inches additional rain for that precipitation event. So that's basically what that means. Let's make sure that site-specifically, we project future climate conditions, understand what the difference is over current historic conditions, and make sure that those differences are factored into a decision-making process. So how can that delta of future conditions affect the decisions that we are making? Important is that we are finding we need expertise in climate analysis, mapping and GIS to understand where infrastructure is laid out, and also contaminated site science and engineering. So while the question is rather basic, and it is possible to do a certain level of screening and focus in quickly, if you need to do a full-scale climate vulnerability assessment, it may take a certain level of expertise to be able to do that. Now, when we do that, it's throughout the life of a site, but it is also multiple levels. We start with a screening, basically, assess the system vulnerability. We look at exposure, and that is that projection of future climate conditions. Is there a significant change over current conditions? And where there is, we make an analysis as to the sensitivity of the infrastructure we're putting in place, let's say the remedy. Is the remedy susceptible? Well, A, is there a change over current conditions? Yes, no. And B, does that change affect our remedy? Because if there's no change and or it doesn't affect our remedy, then we're golden. We document that and we move on. If we do find that there's an overlap between our exposure and our sensitivity, we want to look at our prioritization, identify those adaptation options we have and prioritize them and implement those that are most cost effective. And then, of course, we want to reevaluate this periodically. And that, of course, there are processes in the Superfund program to do that. For example, we heard earlier the 5-year reviews. There's already a question in there about has new information become available that might question the protectiveness of the remedies. That's a perfect example of where we might look back at our historic records, determine that they did use historic data, and maybe determine that we want to do climate vulnerability screening going forward to make, to check and see if we have to make any changes. So once we have that information, this is a quick example. We want to look at the remedy components, you know, for example, groundwater treatment, landfill covers, former waste channels, and then some of the manifestations, I call them, of climate change, and how, whether they, there may be an intersection between the those areas where we see a delta and the remedy components. So in this case, there are some former waste channels which were determined that did not need treatment, but we did, found they did have high exposure to precipitation and flooding, and there was a significant remedy sensitivity. So this is an area where we could have erosion of those channels. We could have a new transport of that contaminant and exposure pathways. So anyway, this is a good example of an area where we might want to take action. Another is those former waste channels related to drought. Well, there's low sensitivity, only median climate exposure change. So that might be an area of lower priority. So anyway, that's the basic concept of how that intersection of exposure and sensitivity are evaluated. And based on that, we can identify adaptation measures we may put in place to ensure that the remedy continues to be protected. So that question of when to consider it, it's never too late. I mentioned earlier, why do we ask this question in CERCLA under the law and the NCP under which Superfund program operates? And that is because there is criteria, the basic criteria for selecting a remedy does include long-term and short-term protectiveness. So if we are not identified building and operating a remedy that provides short and long-term protectiveness, or we don't know for a certainty that that is the case, then we are being inconsistent with CERCLA. So that's basically, it's in the law already. Laws, I think it was very well written and included questions such as this one. So that's why we want to look at that, those future climate conditions to see that the remedy we're putting in place continues to provide protectiveness in the short and long term. It's never late, too late or too early. Early on in the RIFS, you want to know that the nature and extent of contamination, those exposure pathways, et cetera. You know, you can see what they are today. You want to understand what they will be down the road. So at the RI site assessment, RIFS, you can already be looking at, you know, what site conditions are going to be down the road. And of course, in remedy selection, you can identify adaptation measures that need to take place. During design and action, it's preferable that you've already identified those rather than retrofitting. And finally, post-construction, as we mentioned in the five-year review, there's an opportunity to look back and see if forward-looking data was used, and if not, do that climate vulnerability assessment. The key point for this webinar is this concept of leveraging the process, envisioning site reuse and redevelopment. So the existing Superfund community involvement framework is a valuable channel to engage and inform community stakeholders on climate vulnerability and adaptation. So one of the key questions that's also factored into the Superfund decision is reasonably anticipated future land use. So when necessary, we'll consult with the community as to what their vision is for what that community will, land use will be down the road. And that can inform cleanup levels, et cetera. Now we wanna make sure that that anticipated land use is consistent with future climate conditions. So that's an area, just an example of where we can start looking at those future climate conditions and using them to inform the remedy. So we have some really good examples, and we continue to document these to get the word out as to how climate is being factored, climate change is being factored into decisions and site operations in the Superfund process. We've got some great examples down in Region 4 here in Karen McGee and Avast, the Superfund site. So in this case, we're working with the Corps to assess the potential vulnerabilities and adaptation measures that are associated with climate change impacts, such as tidal influence and future groundwater, surface water and actions. So in this case, we're looking forward to see what those future conditions are, and those will help inform remedy decisions. Now, the anticipated end use at that site is residential, commercial, industrial, or recreational. And you'll see, we'll start to see some patterns here. Here in Portsmouth, Rhode Island, another example, this is actually written into the record of decision. It states that the design will ensure no net loss of beach or flood storage and will include storm and sea level rise considerations. So in this case, we're not saying exactly what is going to be done. We're saying what will be considered and what we're aiming for. We're aiming to for a net outcome and a consideration of of future sea level rise considerations. Okay, and then finally, at the RIFS, these actually I should have inverted these, just realized, but in this case, Portland Harbor Superfund site, again, here they're anticipating what future conditions are, and they're stating that the final remedy should consider what these changing climate conditions are going to be when the decision is made. So a couple of examples of how it actually plays out in the field, and these are taken from some of the profiles that we are putting. We have the link at the bottom of the page, or if you Google Superfund climate change, you'll see them. So putting these out, documenting how our project managers, be it fund lead, responsible party lead, or federal facility, how they're factoring climate resilience into their remedies, and quite often how we are working together to prepare the site as a whole for resilience, not just remedy protectiveness, because often you need one or the other. This is a great example of this 183-acre site. About half of it is in a 100-year floodplain, and they have a three-prong adaptation in collaboration with the city, which is now the owner. That includes, okay, weatherproofing the three groundwater extraction systems. We want the infrastructure to be resilient to future climate. But we can also work together at a broader level to address site-wide and, you know, community-wide issues, such as stormwater management. In this case, they remediated and converted a four-acre quarry pond to be a stormwater retention pond that stored up 58,000 cubic yards of on-site and neighborhood runoff. So if we both need this, let's work together to figure out how we can manage those future conditions and build resilience, not only into our remedy, but also into other site infrastructure. Very important point here is that this is one of the sites that we heard about earlier when it comes to repower. We've got a very large 7.2 megawatt farm above a soil cap that's generating some revenue with a space to expand, but also a lot of the power used on site is being generated. So we have some mitigation going on here as well. Another great example is the American Cyanamid. The site is very interesting because it was hit not by one, but by two hurricane scale events. In 2011, Hurricane Irene hit them. They were totally not expecting it. Fortunately, there was no severe loss of remedy protectiveness, but there was a lot of damage to site infrastructure. The site team learned from that. They made very significant changes. For example, in this middle picture here, raising their electrical control infrastructure, I think it was way above the 500-year floodplain, moving a lot of it off, up to higher ground, and building resilience into all the infrastructure. Now, fortunately, they did that, I would say, just in time, because then in 2021, tropical storm hit them again. Can't remember. I think it was the remnants of one. And here is an example of their groundwater treatment system, which was elevated above the 500-year floodplain. And guess what? It was just barely high enough, because the second storm came in and tested all the resilience measures they had to put in place. But that's not only the only thing they're looking at. They're also looking at long-term, similar to what we saw from American Cyanamid and Continental Steel, but building a very large preserve to restore floodplain ecosystems that will help mitigate those dramatic rises and falls in flood levels based on rainfall, et cetera. So here it's almost a system-wide approach to managing, to adapting to future climate change. And that is collaboration with the site team and the community as a whole. So some great examples of how building resilience into our remedies might also include collaborating beyond our site and working with others to build resilience. So I think I'm going a little bit long on time here. I'm not going to go into these examples. The bottom two, we already have the profile on. The next three are coming out in the next couple of months, so you'll be able to learn more about these. And I did want to touch briefly on this question here that I suggested in the opening of those synergies between adaptation and mitigation. An area we've been working in Superfund and other cleanup programs for quite a while now, sorry about that, has to do with Green remediation. How do we build and operate remedies that are protective and have a lower environmental footprint? That low environmental footprint may include, for example, using renewable energy. That reduces our greenhouse gas emissions, but we have found there are many sites where it also provides a more predictable and possibly diversified energy source. Well-built renewable energy generating capacity might be able to continue operating even if we have a major power failure. And we've seen some examples of that in Puerto Rico under Maria. Some of those were put in place. Sequester carbon through revegetation. Here we are removing carbon from the atmosphere. So that is a mitigating action where we're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere. But of course, that revegetation also immobilizes contaminated media, enhances soil quality, and reduces erosion. So we've got both mitigation and adaptation benefits from that. And then controlling stormwater through green infrastructure. We saw some good examples of that. The concept of not requiring energy to treat that water, it comes off site clean, it can be discharged directly into a stream, but it also, that's on the mitigation side, we don't need that energy. And of course, on the adaptation side, we are protecting our critical infrastructure on site by efficiently managing that stormwater. So anyway, there's some great examples out there. There's Resolve in Massachusetts, Connecticut and Idaho, so Rocky Mountain West, New England. We have more examples in the South, in the West Coast, that will be coming out soon. But anyway, lots of examples of how we are implementing measures that get us both mitigation, adaptation, synergies. And this, I'll just put this out there as a bit of a teaser. All that is wrapped up into the concept of ecosystem services. That's what these adaptation measures are getting us. That's what they are. They're ecosystem services where examples include climate resilience, reducing erosion, water quality, green space, et cetera. So there's a lot of work going on in that area. For example, EPA released the National Ecosystem Services Classification System. We have a white paper on on considering ecosystem services as part of site cleanups. Anyway, there's a lot of work going on in that area. Be on the lookout for it at this point. But I think it's a very good tool for us all going forward. And that's what I have to say. I'm not sure how I did on time, but I hope it wasn't too long. Thank you.
And thank you, Carlos. My name is Kelly Runzel, and I am going to talk a little bit about the ecosystem and the climate resiliency that Carlos was talking about. I am with the Student Conservation Association, and I am representing one of many local nonprofits and national nonprofits that are working to conserve and build local resiliency. So my hope from this talk is that you are inspired and find some real life examples of how you can engage communities and youth in the remediation process and the design and development of great, strong local communities, resilient communities. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about SEA. So next slide, please. We are the oldest and the largest conservation corps in the country. We've been around for over 65 years now, and we are celebrating our 100,000th member that was in the field this year. So we have alumni that range in age from 80 to 16 right now. And with that, our mission is to create the next generation of conservation leaders. And we do that by providing green jobs and conservation to youth in all 50 states. We also provide equitable access to nature. So we identify communities that have a need for local green spaces and nature, and we provide access and help build that access. And we also elevate the youth voice in climate action. And that's one of the joys that I have with this job is if you speak to our youth, you will realize that climate action and environmental justice might mean something different to local communities. And Superfund redevelopment does bridge both of those things. And Carlos mentioned that earlier, and Alexis in the talk, is that we're not only addressing climate action, but we're also addressing the local needs of environmental justice in the work that we're doing. And so I want to thank everyone for joining us today, and thank you for your work that you're doing in this process. So we have about 35% of our work is front country, 30% is back country, and 5% is in urban areas. And I'm mostly going to speak about our work in urban areas. And later on, I'll provide three examples of how we're working on remediation efforts in cities. So next slide, please. We have various ways that we engage our youth. So we have our traditional core model and crew model. And that is where we have a team of youth or young adults that get together and they work specifically on addressing conservation needs. And a lot of the reasons, if you do not or have never heard of the Student Conservation Association in the past, it's because we're mostly behind the scenes. We're the boots on the ground. We work with our largest partner is the National Park Service. We work with local city municipalities like the City of Houston, the City of Chicago. We also work with the Army Corps of Engineers to help with their conservation efforts. And so most of that work is through our core programs and crew programs. We also have internships, and that is a more technical job. And those internships are for young adults, and they can range in time periods from 6 months to 2 years. And they work with a specific job. So it could be GIS work. It could be project planning, plant identification, things of that nature. And that is something that could be of use in the remedial investigation phase and the design phase. And then we also have our urban community cores, and that can start as early as middle school with our urban treehouse education programs that are in local schools and communities. But then we have high school programming, which is almost an introduction into conservation and climate action work. And then we have our young adult programs, which are professional workforce development and training programs where they'll work full time. We provide them paid professional licensing and certification so that they can have a future livelihood and continue the work within their community. Next slide, please. Thank you. So now we're going to get into kind of our urban green. And that's what we call resilient cities work. And so this is kind of an overshot of some of the communities. When we do an assessment, we look at various factors as far as kind of the walk or the distance to the park, if the community has been redlined in the past, if they're experiencing environmental injustice. And so we not only listen and assess our core nonprofit partners and our local community partners, but also we look on the national level as far as what has been identified by our agency partners as well. Next slide, please. Great. So we all know the need. I don't think we need to spend a lot of time, but as climate action and weather events increase, we find that there is an increase in heat islands, air and water pollution, destructive flooding. And so we address all of these areas in the work that we're doing. But most importantly, we engage the community and the youth by giving them a paid livelihood and job, just because we understand that often the environmental factors that they're dealing with also affects their household income and their livelihood in the area. So we believe that it's very important to give a good paid job for all of our youth that are working in these programs. Next slide, please. Here's a little bit of our vision. I mentioned that earlier, but a lot of the things that we incorporate into our work, it's not only just the conservation work or the boots on the ground work, whether it's watershed restoration, wildlife habitat restoration, tree planting, we do it all. But we also try to incorporate soft skill training. So we have financial literacy incorporated into all of our programs, teamwork, public speaking. We've used our youth to help canvas communities to do public assessments for park design and trail design work. So all of that, we believe, will help kind of add value into the education, the green jobs. We also try to elevate the youth voice in climate action so we can identify the needs that are most pressing for our communities. It helps with their physical, mental health, and it helps create an equitable future and racial justice as well. Next slide, please. Great. So now let's focus specifically on urban green and how that works with Superfund sites. And so there's a couple needs that I wanted to mention prior to getting into our case examples. And that's the first thing is that large scale weather events and sometimes remove the fence line of Superfund sites. So I know that this is going to be planned and as far as the project manager is going to take these long-term events into effect, but we found that you cannot assume that the fence line will be the only place you'll have to kind of work within the remediation efforts. And so I'll get into a couple examples in the future as far as that kind of assumption. And then the community does not have a strong grasp of the dangers and or the positive outcomes that the remediation efforts involve with Superfund sites. I think we could assess a local community, and many people don't even know what a Superfund is or how that affects or could affect their family and their long-term health. So I think that one of the things that we help address is that public education aspect of, you know, what is this site? What is the cleanup going to do? And how can we elevate your voice in the design of this next site? So we help support with that as well. And then we also help identify additional needs for the community and help with the programmatic aspects of the post-construction use of the site. So we often work with many capital projects. Our students and our youth do not get trained or use heavy machinery. However, we often participate and work with construction companies, the Trust for Public Lands during large-scale capital projects to help with the post-construction maintenance of that facility in association with the landowner or the land management partner. Next slide, please. Great. So now I'm going to get into some of our projects. And these are existing projects that are happening right now. We have a tree planting program that's happening in Northwest Indiana. And if you can see, I know you'll probably have to squint and lean into the computer to see this aerial shot. But this is one of our eco shields that we're building in the city of Whiting. And we're doing this in partnership with the U.S. Forest Service. We're working with the city of Whiting, the mayor. We're working with corporate partners in the area. And then we're also working with a myriad of community partners. So if you look at that, you'll see that there is a refinery that's to the northwest of that green box, and then a residential community that's to the southeast of that box. And what was designed and our youth help participate in the design of this is we're building an eco shield. And so those green boxes will be a highly densely populated, almost wall of conifer trees. The big problem that we're trying to address and why we chose conifer trees is to help remove the particulate matter from the air. And our youth are going to be the ones that are helping not only with the planting efforts, so they'll get good paying jobs and professional certifications and training to plant those trees, but then they're also going to be helping with the public education aspect of that. So we'll be hosting community events, we'll be working with the schools, we'll be educating the community on what this means and how this is going to improve their general health and well-being. Next slide, please. The next program that I'm going to talk about is we started in Northwest Indiana and the city of Whiting, and now we're going to go way south to Houston, Texas. And this is a picture of one of the bayou systems that we're working on and the riparian buffer zone mitigation. And so what we're trying to address with this this program, and we're working in partnership with TCEQ, the City of Houston, and HPARD. And HPARD is the Houston Parks and Rec Department. And so during the analysis of the floodplain evolution in the City of Houston, they channelized some of their bayous. And you can see with the picture that it has the original bayou that is in dark gray in the middle of the channel. And then you could see the channelized section of that. And so with that, after the channelization, we've found that there's a lot of non-point source pollution that is coming from downstream sources. And the reason why that non-point source pollutants and the sediment is going upstream is because of climate action involved or climate-related large-scale weather events. So Hurricane Harvey was one of the examples of we found that those pollutants from downstream actually started moving upstream during that large scale weather event. And so because it has been channelized and channelized by concrete, there isn't a natural system of an riparian buffer to help filter that sediment and those non-point source pollutants from that channel and from that waterway. So what we're doing is, and you'll have to squint, but I'll talk you through it. But we have sections of the area, and we have an intern that is a technically trained arbor that is choosing and helping us select and map out the reforestation and riparian buffer zone systems and plantings for this area. So we have an intern working within the city that's doing that, and she's plotting out that riparian buffer zone replanting. And then we have crews that are going in and they're doing the planting efforts. So with that, we're hoping to see, we've been working with the program, it's about in its fourth year. And so we're excited to see kind of the long-term data and aspects of the water quality for that bayou system. And we're working on many bayou systems within the Houston area. So next slide, please. And here is another example, but this is focused more on the public education aspect. I mentioned that there is a stigma often attached to Superfund sites and what and the process of remediation. So we are trying to help with that through public education programs. And so this is a specific program that SEA worked with MPS and the DOE to help educate about the opening of Manhattan Project National Historic Park in Hanford, Washington. And so what we did was, prior to kind of the start of and the launch of opening the site for educational content and opening the museum, we had an intern that went into the schools and started with elementary school youth and educating them about what a Superfund is, what is the Manhattan Project, what's the history behind it, and then what are the ecological aspects and effects of that Superfund site, and then how the DOE and MPS is working together to help not only educate, but remediate that site. So that's what our intern did. And we've had interns not only working within the local school system to help with that educational content, but also at the museum to help create and draft that content. Next slide, please. Great. So this is I welcome any questions. I'm trying to blow through this quickly because I want to be sensitive to your time and make sure that there's enough time to answer your question. But here are some specific ideas of how we can work together with landowners and land management partners and consultants and even construction companies to help with the remediation effort of Superfund sites. So first thing that I want to mention is that much like how Carlos said, bringing in the community and assessing these questions of climate change earlier is always best, but it's never too late. So we always recommend that involving the community before public comment on any design is always the most ideal. And I know that you all are probably facing many challenges. This is a tough job to work through the remediation of Superfund sites, but we believe that involving the community can help with that, especially if you have a nonprofit or community partner that can work as the intermediary between the local citizens and community members. So our youth have been involved in canvassing and supporting education programs within the community prior to public comment for any type of designs that are happening. We found that it is highly effective to use local youth. We hire all of our local youth for our Urban Green programs from local schools. So it's often a neighbor or a community member that you go to church with that would be working on these programs. And the community and the neighbors trust the local youth. And so we found that the content that we're receiving from our assessments are high quality when we utilize the local youth. We can support with the remedial design through internships. So technical skills and youth that we will hire as an organization based on the project requirements. So we have a recruiting department that works with a lot of universities and colleges across the country to post these job opportunities so we can get the top echelon of candidates for these internships. I mentioned a little bit about the public education programs during construction. That is also an important aspect, is to understand the construction process, the permitting process, how long a project might take. I think that's also something that we found our youth are highly effective at, is a really communicating the process of construction. And then post-construction, we can help provide programming for the area, depending on what you choose the design to be. Quality checks, analysis of the post-construction work and the positive benefits to the environment. And so our youth are something that we feel would be a win-win, because they would gain those job skills, and then they would also be able to meet a tremendous need of gathering data and analysis for the post-construction benefits for the environment and the community. And then one other thing that nonprofit partners and community partners can help with is we can often, depending on depending on the type of project and the type of work, we can often help leverage funding sources from other agency partners, from other initiatives, even private philanthropy and private corporations, to help create a holistic program so that the remediation efforts do cross the fence line and do kind of the most and the best good for the community. Next slide, please. Great. And then next slide, please. Great. And then why Urban Green and why SCA or a local nonprofit is again, we feel that these projects are not only good to transform the environment, but we believe that they can transform the lives of our youth. A lot of the problems that we're trying to face right now with climate change will most likely outlive us. So empowering the next generation of conservation leaders is key to creating long-term change. And that's the core to our mission, is that we believe that a lot of the things that we're facing are going to outlive us, and we need our youth to and their creative energy to inspire us and teach us about what is important to them and what we can do in the future. Next slide. Here's a little bit more about the social and emotional development. We not only track our climate data, we track the growth of our youth. And this is some of the proud examples of how our youth are more self-confident. They're better able to engage in community building in their backyard. They have a greater level of conservation awareness, and they believe that they can be the change makers of the next generation. Next slide, please. Great. And then our conservation metrics, we work with primarily iTree. It is a joint technology tool that was created by multiple stakeholders, including the U.S. Forest Service, and we're able to assess the carbon offsets for our tree planting, and not only assess the carbon offsets, but also what stormwater retention we're able to gain from our tree plantings, sediment, particulate matter in the air and the soil as well. We also, we try to measure our water retention, number of acres of riparian areas. We create biodiversity, and then of course, our recreation and equitable access to nature. We utilize the Trust for Public Lands data and research about a 10-minute walk from each green space. Great, next slide. And that's the conclusion. I do welcome any questions. Here's my contact information if we are not able to have enough time to answer your questions, or if you have any ideas or would like to get creative as far as how to use community action and development and youth in your plans. I'm happy to talk or recommend or connect you with any of the folks in our network. We do appreciate having the opportunity to talk today. So thank you again.
Hi, thank you. You got me clapping for Kelly. Thank you so much for Carlos and Kelly for joining us. I think we have a couple more slides to run through really quick that Chelsea's going to take us through, just so some of the other resources from Superfund Redevelopment are top of mind. And then we'll try to leave some time for questions and thank our presenters again. So Chelsea, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Hi. Thanks, everybody. And thank you so much, Kelly and Carlos. This has been really great. We're so glad to have the opportunity to bring folks the very latest on climate resiliency within the lens of Superfund and Superfund redevelopment. Such a key component that we have historically considered and continue to prioritize throughout the cleanup process and beyond. And so cool to bring the SCA into the mix here with us and learn about the great work that they have going on in relation to this topic as well. We're really excited to have you on. As Alexa said, we're pretty short on time here, so I just want to really quickly breeze through these next few slides just so that you can see some of the resources that Superfund Redevelopment Program has to offer. So next slide, please. Okay, so at this point, you may be wondering, what are the specifics here and what kind of support can EPA offer to help facilitate reuse at Superfund sites? Well, EPA has a whole host of tools and resources, and here are some right here. There's links for each of these. I had talking points for the different resources we were showing here, but feel free to follow the links. And if you still have questions, we would love to chat with you more. Feel free to follow up, and we'd be happy to dive deeper and get into the specifics of these. You know, we at SRP feel very lucky to be able to offer this support, and we really do our best to try and bring awareness to these tools so that folks know when the timing is right, they can reach out to us and take advantage of the toolkit to help support and guide them through the Superfund redevelopment process. So, yeah, please take a look and let us know if you have questions. Next slide, please. Okay, so just very quickly highlighting a specific resource, the Superfund Redevelopment Tool. It's our Superfund Redevelopment Mapper. And I, again, won't go into too much detail, but especially won't just because we actually have an entire webinar dedicated to this awesome application that we've linked right here in the slide deck for you. So we encourage you to check that out because it's a really deep dive on the resource, and there are just so many possibilities for using the tool. So this kind of key info. It's valuable to stakeholders so that they can make informed decisions for land reuse that's compatible with local land use requirements and community needs and priorities. It's available online. You can use it on your computer and your phone. And yeah, it's just really great for a variety of stakeholders. So check it out. And again, please let us know if you have questions. Happy to help. Next slide, please. Okay, so speaking of amazing resources, if you have questions or are looking for support, please don't hesitate to reach out to the coordinator in your area. So here at EPA, we've got 10 regions to support implementation of EPA's programs, including the Superfund and Superfund redevelopment program. So each region has a Superfund redevelopment coordinator, and that's your local contact. They have a wealth of knowledge and expertise in the area, and they will gladly take questions, brainstorm with you, and give insight to whatever redevelopment ideas you may have. So they're your best bet for local redevelopment inquiries, but you can always reach out to us at headquarters. Next slide, please. So yeah, so this is our contact info, mine as well as my colleague Alexis. And with that, Alexis, would you like to add anything before I turn it over to the Q&A?
Thank you, Chelsea. No, I mean, just really quickly, again, thanking Carlos and thanking Kelly Renzel so much, our guests from Student Conservation Association. I learned a ton about your organization today, and I just can't wait to learn more. And we're really hopeful that folks that are from Superfund site teams all over the country will kind of have a good understanding of all the amazing ways that you work with young people in kind of pursuing these very important projects. And we're just, it's really exciting. So thanks for spending the time with us. Carlos, again, thanks for sharing all the nuts and bolts about, you know, how EPA can kind of help sites stay protected in light of all the events that we are experiencing for climate change. Thanks, Chelsea. So yeah, let's go to, I think Jean and Josie might help with some Q&A and see what we have time for, but thanks everybody for joining us as well.
Great, thanks Alexis, thanks Chelsea. We do have some questions that in the Q&A that I would like to pose. First off, is EPA accounting for climate change differently for coastal Superfund communities? This might be a question for Carlos.
Yes, thanks for the question. Not sure if what differently with respect to what, I guess, but a lot of the pilot sites for which we're working with the project managers conducting climate vulnerability assessments are coastal. Quite a few of them are from Region 9, both open water and bay areas, as well as Region 10. And again, what we're looking at there is, you know, as I described earlier, what are those significant deltas in climate conditions going forward? What are those interactions between, you know, storm surge, sea level rise, and runoff conditions? And we often model or project what a worst case scenario might be so that that can be factored into the decision making process. So in a sense, the climate manifestations that were present on coastal areas will be different than upland areas, of course, but that's why there's a whole range of parameters we look at when we do that climate vulnerability assessment. So I'm not sure that was very a good answer, but definitely the, you know, the types of factors will be different, of considerations will be different in a coastal than an upland area. The five examples that we put up on the, you know, the profiles that we have so far, there is a range. There's one, for example, Iron Mountain Mine in California. That definitely is a, you know, high, you know, Rocky Mountain, Sierra Nevada, actually, area. It's got different issues, you know, drought, fire, snowfall, than, for example, what some of the coastal sites we have, such as American Cyanamid. So I hope, sorry I can't be more specific, but I hope that helps.
Great. Thanks, Carlos. And just a reminder to all the participants that they can find the contact information for all the speakers on the registration page. So if you need to follow up with anyone individually, feel free to do so. I have a question for Kelly. Has the SCA worked with or partnered with the Superfund Job Training Initiative, as far as you know?
Not that I know of, but I loved hearing Chelsea speak about it because I think it is a great opportunity for us, especially with our identified areas. We would love to add any additional value to our youth's livelihood and professional certifications in the future. I think it sounds like a great program.
Great. Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate that. I have another question for Carlos. Does EPA offer help to Superfund communities to evaluate cleanups for climate change implications?
So that's a good question. I'm working with my colleagues. And by the way, this webinar is an opportunity actually for us to work more closely. Since we're not co-located, a lot of us are working remotely still. We go in, you know, 2-3 days a week, but we don't always coincide. So this is actually getting ready for this webinar has been a great opportunity for us to speak with Chelsea and Alexis and the work they do on the redevelopment side versus I am on the TFC division, a different division, Technology, Innovation, and Field Services. So we're trying to understand, you know, I'm working, looking very specifically at remedies and how we work with our RPMs to assess whether they're being protective down the road. But there are other decisions that are being made at the site level, including that whole concept of reuse. So that's one of the areas we're exploring how the technical assistance provided to you know, to the communities can include or does it include that capacity for them to make their own independent assessments as to what these future climate conditions are. So that's a really good question. We're asking it ourselves and what that process would look like. We're trying to figure that one out. And maybe Chelsea might be able to better answer that question.
Chelsea, do you have anything to add?
I do not. If whoever submitted the question wants to discuss further, I think Carlos and I would be happy to follow up. If you get an email. Thank you.
Great. Wonderful. So I have a sort of a specific longer question, so bear with me. This is a site-specific question. So we are working currently with our RPM on siting waste consolidation areas to accept mine waste contamination that will be dredged out of one of our major rivers. There are quite a bit of criterion that need to be considered, including identifying areas close to the area to be dredged that are in a floodplain. Due to climate change projections in our area, there will most likely be more precipitation during winter months and the potential for recontamination in the floodplain where these waste consolidation areas will be located. Are there other Superfund sites in the nation that this participant can look at that are dealing with a similar situation? Not to mention these areas are culturally sensitive to our tribe, so this exercise is quite challenging. Carlos, do you have any thoughts about that? Any recommendations? Carlos, you're muted, just to let you know.
Yes, thank you. I did peek at the question as I saw it's coming from Kirtleene without identifying the individual, the Kirtleene Bunker Hill Superfund site. And just so you know, I know there are multiple RPMs. It's a very large site. And one of the RPMs is Edna Maureen. He's involved, or one of his colleagues is involved. He did happen to participate in the at the National Association of Regional Project Managers training we had this year. It was in Pittsburgh. He did participate, and he did was in our climate resilience course. So I know he's up to speed. Maybe he'd be a good person to reach out to. We've worked with him in the past on questions, climate related questions. And for Bunker Hill. So you might check with them directly, but also there are other mining sites. Mining sites tend to have a lot of characteristics and might, you know, a lot of potential for impact by climate that we are writing profiles on. So I mentioned Iron Mountain Mine in California. They have quite a few issues as well, mostly related with runoff. I said mine drainage, which is less of an issue at Bunker Hill, Elizabeth Mine in the Northeast. I'd be happy to follow up. I'll take the requester's question information and follow with them individually on that.
Great. Thank you, Carlos. Appreciate that. Jean, I think we're pretty much out of time here. If you'd like to go ahead and go to your closing statements. I really appreciate everyone's questions in the chat. And if you have any follow-up questions, do feel free to contact any of our speakers using their information. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Josie. And thank you to all of our speakers for sharing their expertise and time today. I do want to walk through just a few quick reminders before we close things out and end our session. The first thing I want to do is just remind everyone that we have a whole variety of resources available on characterizing and cleaning up hazardous waste sites at the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN.org. So I encourage you to visit us there. And you may find it helpful to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month, where we'll highlight seminars such as today. So I encourage you to sign up so that you can stay informed when we offer additional webinars. The other thing I wanted to point out, if you were not here at the very beginning, some of you have asked about copies of the presentation materials and links that were highlighted. We have already posted those materials along with speaker information on the seminar homepage. So the seminar homepage is shown in red on this slide. If you happen to be replaying the recording of the webinar, that URL will still work, so you can type it in manually to your browser. I'll just encourage everybody to visit the homepage. You can download the presentation materials. You can find contact information for our speakers. And please know you may need to scroll up and down to find the various sections or use the plus and minus icons on the right to collapse or expand various sections. But this area is up from today forward and will be available for anyone to access materials that were highlighted today. And a number of you have asked for participation certificates, and we will be happy to issue those to you. And to receive a participation certificate, you'll need to fill out our online feedback form for today's session. You'll be able to access the feedback form on the seminar homepage that I showed on the previous slide. So this is the same page we sent you to when you registered. It's the same page you went to when you checked in. So you should already have a copy of that URL somewhere in your calendar or your emails. Or if not, as I said, we've made it available in the recording on the slide that I just showed. If you fill out the online feedback form and then make sure you check the box at the very bottom of that form, certifying you were here for the entire delivery or replayed the whole archive, as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then have immediate access to a certificate that you can either save or print out for your own records. Now, we'll also email a copy of that to you, but sometimes those emails get caught by junk or spam filters. So I encourage you to download it or print it out from the confirmation screen when you see it. If you happen to join with other people at one location, you can share the link to the seminar homepage and let others fill out the feedback form, even if they didn't register on their own. Each person can fill it out to get their own certificate of participation. So please, if you were the person who signed up, I encourage you to share this link, the seminar homepage, with your colleagues so they can give us their thoughts and get their own certificate. Our session was recorded just as the others are in the Superfund Redevelopment Program series. You'll automatically get an email from me as soon as that archive is available for on-demand playback. So I encourage you to keep your eyes on your inbox and then feel free to share the link to the recording with anyone else that you think this will be a valuable expenditure of their time. Now, for those of you who are the lucky ones replaying this recorded version of the webinar, again, all the URLs we showed on the slides here in the recording are working. And right about now in the archived version, there will be a button floating right above my head that should have a link to that seminar homepage as well as the seminar feedback form. So you can feel free to click that, share your feedback based off of your replay of the archive, and you can still get your participation certificate based off of watching the archived session. So with that, I want to thank all of the presenters, the nearly 150 individuals who joined us for today's session. We hope that you found this to be an informative session and you will join us on a future CLUIN Internet seminar. And with that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.